This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne, in for Matthew Petty. The legislative session in Tallahassee starts next month, but lawmakers have been hard at work moving bills through committee ahead of the lawmaking season. From education to workers' compensation, there's a host of new bills up for debate. To make sense of the legislative agenda taking shape is Nick Evans. He's a reporter at our sister station, WFSU, in Tallahassee. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with some of the bills that are coming out of committee heading to the full floor of the legislature. And there is an education bill that tackles Bright Futures and community college. Can you just give us the rundown on that?
So it's actually two bills. You have one that's being carried by Senator Bill Galvano, and that would make Florida Bright Futures scholarship program, like the academic scholars level, that would go to 100%, and would also give a stipend for textbooks. The lower level, the medallion scholars, would be they would get 75% of their tuition covered. It does a handful of other things, but basically this was a big chunk of Senate Bill 374 from last year that is a big priority for Senate President Joe Negron.
Why is that? Why is this so important to Joe Negron?
Senate President Negron came in with a couple of things that he wanted to do, really three big priorities. One was build a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee, done. The other was work on getting the university system of Florida on a par with something like the University of North Carolina or the University of Texas at Austin. He wants Florida's universities to be destination-level institutions that people from across the country will want to come to. And so what he's trying to do is he's trying to ensure that the good students that we have in the state don't leave to go somewhere else, in the hopes that by doing that and by doing a number of other things to attract good faculty into the system, that our schools will you know, just begin working up to being on that same level.
Now, is this after Bright Futures had been restructured in the past? I mean, this sounds a little bit similar to how Bright Futures worked maybe a decade ago.
Yeah, I believe it is. It is a return to a previous system. And the other thing that we should point out is, although Senate Bill 374 was vetoed by Governor Scott, he vetoed the policy, but not the funding. So I'm under the impression that the schools are doing a lot of the things that will be put into place permanently by SB 4, but it's not permanent right now. It's that they're doing it on a this year basis because they're sort of like following the ideas that were in that previous bill to the extent that they can, and what they're hoping to do with this bill that Galvano is pushing through is to make those moves permanent moving forward.
Gotcha. Now you said there were two higher education
right.
bills, but what's the other one, Nick?
The other one has to do with community colleges, and this was part of the reason why Governor Scott vetoed the bill last year. He felt like some of the stuff in the community college piece he wasn't crazy about, and so now they're trying to do it as two separate things. Primarily, what this does is it gives a whole different structure for governance for the community college system. Right now, they're in the same vein with all the other school systems, and so they wanted to have their own separate governance system to really emphasize, you know, the mission of the community college system, because it isn't quite the same as, you know, universities. Right
now, what's the appetite for these bills making it through the legislature and the legislative session rather, and through the governor's desk? I mean, do you get a sense that folks are optimistic that these will pass?
I mean, you can never like prejudge this, but in the Senate, I think they've got a very, very good chance. What will happen when they run into the House? Lawmakers in that chamber have been very skeptical of the university system writ large. In particular, they've been kind of wary of the sort of spending that happens semi-openly with the direct support organizations that many of the schools run. They use this for salaries for some of the professors. They use it for travel, and the House members look at that and they they see potential waste. They see potentially nefarious activity, right? They mm-hmm. see stuff that, you know, maybe the schools are getting away with a little bit too much. They're being a bit cavalier in how they spend their money.
So we could have a fight simmering between the two chambers over higher ed, it sounds like.
Yeah. Same story as always, right?
Yes, right. Well, let's move on. Another bill. This doesn't sound as fun as higher education, but it is very important. The Direct Primary Care Agreements. Nick, what are these things?
Okay, so this is a Senate bill. It's backed by a guy named Tom Lee. And what this does is you set up a subscription type service with your primary care doctor. And you pay some amount of money every month, and you can go in and you can get your basic checkup, or you know you feel a little under the weather, you can go in and you can get that taken care of. The idea being that you're not using an insurance company. The idea is that because you cut out that third party, you can potentially lower the cost of getting that service. This doesn't qualify as a insurance plan, though. So if something like the individual mandate stays in place, you would have to use the direct primary care system that you have plus a cut rate insurance policy to meet the requirements of the mandate, or you would suffer a penalty, or the individual mandate might disappear. It's a way of trying to get at least a baseline level of care for a lower level of cost. We'll see how well that comes off. It's something that Senator Lee has been working on for a number of years, this has been something that people have been looking at and wanting to get done. We'll see how it works in practice.
How much of the passage of this bill depends on that individual mandate being repealed, or is this thing dead if that doesn't happen?
You know, I don't think so. I think that this is something that the state legislature is, or at least the people that are interested in getting this done in the state legislature, they want this regardless of what happens with the individual mandate. I think their argument is that they'll use the direct primary care agreement to get their baseline coverage taken care of, but they'll also have to get a catastrophic plan. And hopefully, one would assume, if it's just that, the rates for that would be significantly lower. And potentially, those two things together might end up costing less than a full-on insurance plan.
Great. Well, let's move on to another bill moving through the legislative process, the Crisis Pregnancy Centers. Nick, what's the story behind this one?
Okay. So what this would do is it would create a bit more oversight for these service providers. These are the folks that you see when you're driving down like I-75 and you see those billboards that say, are you pregnant and don't know what to do? Call us. It's those sorts of groups. Now, the state has been giving money to these service providers for a number of years, a couple of million dollars every year, but they aren't like really codified in state statute. So this would do that, and it would place new restrictions on how they do their job. It would push DOH, the Department of Health, to have explicit benchmarks and explicit requirements for, how they provide crisis pregnancy services. However, it also has a bit of language that says the groups that the Department of Health is supposed to contract with cannot have anything to do with abortion. They have to be agencies or providers that encourage childbirth, right? The state right now contracts with Planned Parenthood for a number of different to provide a number of different services in different areas of the state. If this were to pass as it is, that would probably not be quite that would be much more difficult to continue.
So we're looking at another legislative fight here, obviously.
One would think. I mean, the thing that's interesting is that Planned Parenthood, at least in some of the early hearings on this, is they are very okay, it seems, with the idea of a bit more oversight of how these crisis pregnancy centers operate. They believe that, yes, it is important to have a bit more of the department, like getting in and governing, you know, what it is they do, how they do it, et cetera. But the other bit, the other piece where, oh, by the way, we're basically going to never, ever contract with an agency that operates in Planned Parenthood sphere with their full range of services, that understandably they are a little uncomfortable with.
Well, moving on to a final bill that, you are following as it makes its way through the legislature is the workers' comp assignment of benefits. Nick, why is this one on your radar?
Okay, so these are actually, again, two separate bills. The reason why these are interesting is that I think if you were in any given session, if there was nothing at all going on outside of the sphere of the Capitol complex itself, that is to say, if we were on the sunniest, most beautiful day possible, getting workers' compensation passed or assignment of benefits reform passed, either one of those would be really, really difficult. I mean, in the best possible situation, these would be very, very heavy lifts.
And why is that?
And yet, these are really difficult because they infect so many different areas of the state and so many different interest groups and so many different industries. Workers' comp touches everything from construction to restaurants to,
everything, pretty much just about every industry
everything.
In the state.
Yeah, every industry in the state has to, at some level, you know, have workers' comp insurance. And trying to reform that is difficult because there are so many different groups that will want to have a say on it. Assignment of benefits is similar because when we saw a Senate workshop on this, the chair of the committee, Anna Terry Flores from Miami, and Senator Rene Garcia, also from Miami, both Republicans. The thing that they mentioned that they really hammered home to the people that were there in front of them from the repair industry, from the insurance industry, and from the trial lawyers that represent people who are contesting their insurance claims. The one thing that they have heard from every year, more than anything else, is the cost of property insurance. And so the idea of filing – the idea of moving forward on a bill that will make it harder for homeowners to get their insurance company to pay the full freight of the repair after a pipe bursts in the middle of the night, or make it more difficult for them to move through the process – That's a political loser of an issue for Republicans or Democrats. And they're in the other thing is that because this is geographically centered in an area like Miami that has a ton of political weight in Tallahassee, it's really difficult to get that group of lawmakers on board with reform. The House has put these two bills forward after moving through a single committee. That is not something that typically happens. Most bills go through at least three stops. The House has instead moved these basically right to the floor. They are there on day one, ready to go. But the Senate is not in any way on the same page. So these two bills are at loggerheads in terms of where they are in the process and where the two chambers are in terms of their attitudes on the issues.
Nick, before I let you go, just want to get your thoughts on another thing that I like to follow during the legislative session, and that is the relationship between the House Speaker and the Senate President. What can we expect from this legislative session about the working relationship between House Speaker Richard Corcoran and Senate President Joe Negron?
Well, I think that as long as – I think I'm bringing in a completely different issue, but I think that it is informative. The sort of the cloud that is hanging over the legislature right now, of course, is the sexual harassment allegations against Senate Budget Chief Jack Latvala, or I guess at this point former Senate Budget Chief Jack Latvala. He hasn't left the chamber, but he is no longer serving in that role. Corcoran has been very, very vocal about wanting to see wanting to get his pound of flesh out of Latvala for the for what has happened and for the sort of allegations that are out there. He was on C-SPAN yesterday saying that the Senate looks as though it's moving toward expulsion. I tend to think as long as there is a way for Corcoran to so easily needle the other chamber, there will continue to be some friction. I think that Senate President Negron and House Speaker Corcoran will present themselves as just the best of partners, working diligently to you know make a better Florida for Florida voters. But I think behind the scenes they continue to probably rub each other the wrong way in the interest of you know getting their own priorities for their own chambers advanced.
Well, Nick Evans is a reporter with our sister station WFSU in Tallahassee, keeping a close eye on the upcoming legislative session. Nick Evans, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, anytime. Happy to help.
Coming up, a new documentary explores the rise of the Jones High School marching band during segregation and what band leaders and players taught their community about coming together. That's ahead when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne. The documentary Marching Forward chronicles the rise of the all-black marching band at Jones High School. Students at the University of Central Florida, under the direction of Robert Casanello and Lisa Mills, interviewed band leaders and players, collecting hundreds of hours of firsthand accounts of what it was like playing in the band. The story focuses on efforts to get the band to the 1964 World's Fair and what it meant for these Orlando students to experience the segregated South on the brink of the civil rights movement. Well, joining us in the studio is Lisa Mills. She's an associate professor of film in the School of Visual Art and Design at the University of Central Florida. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
And also Robert Casanello. He is the associate professor of history at UCF. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Thank you.
So, Robert, I want to start with you. Paint me a picture of Orlando in the 1950s. What was it like?
Well, Orlando is in the 1950s wasn't like we see Orlando today because it was a much smaller community. It was an urban center, but it was an urban center that fed a lot of the agricultural regions, has a railroad hub, a banking hub, and things like this. And in the 1950s, it was getting ready to make a transition. The city leaders, the Chamber of Commerce, really wanted to point Orlando in an economic direction that would follow eventually down this sort of Sunbelt path, as opposed to the previous economic endeavors that you know had caused Orlando to grow in the early part of the 20th century.
Lisa, the film is called Marching Forward. It's a feature-length documentary film, and it chronicles the Jones High School marching band. Where did the idea for the high school to start a marching band come from? How did that come to fruition?
Well, the establishment of the Jones High School marching band was the result of something called the establishment of the patch at Florida A&M University. Dr. Foster, who was the band director there, went out and recruited excellent musicians like James Wilson to come to FAMU, be a part of the band, get their degrees, and then go out into their communities and establish marching bands at black high schools. And the purpose of those bands was to elevate the community surrounding the high schools through music.
And Robert, what was the kind of the relationship, the race relationship in the 1950s around this time here in Orlando, and how would the high school band kind of move that forward?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and it's really hard to ascertain an accurate or correct picture because so much is lost. Part of the thing, and this is not uncommon in other communities, but in places like Orlando, the main predominant newspaper would hesitate to report civil rights incidents. So we kind of don't get a sense of exactly what a good measure of what race relations were unless we talk to people or we do kind of like community-based research. Our impression was that in Orlando that there was a racial tension, but it was kind of mediated because of efforts by local leaders to kind of reach out to the African-American community and at least have a dialogue. And that was much different than in places like, say, Birmingham or in Mississippi, where you would have, you know, open hostility with, you know, the media swooping in soon to kind of depict this to the rest of the country. Orlando was much more closer in those regards to a place like Atlanta, you know, where the mayor was sort of looking towards the future to say, you know, we really have to, you know, be part of the solution, not part of the problem here.
Lisa, how did you stumble upon the story of the Jones High School marching band? Where did this come from?
Well, this is where we can talk about the relationship between Robert and me. We are colleagues at UCF. This is the fourth documentary that we've worked together on with our students. And Robert brings these unique historical stories to the class. They're usually stories of our community and our state that people aren't aware of. And with the students, we work on visualizing these stories through the film medium. So Robert gets all the credit for bringing this story into the classroom. And I just work with the students to try to develop who are the characters, what will the story structure be, and what kind of production methods are we going to use to tell the story through film.
Robert, one of the main characters in this story is James W. Wilson, who was later called Chief, I believe, by the bandmates. Tell me a little bit about him. How did he come to Jones High School, and how did he get this program started?
Well, Chief Wilson was born and raised in Sanford. He and his family have deep roots in Sanford. And so when he was a young man ready to go to college, he went to FAMU, as Lisa earlier mentioned. And he decided to come back to Orlando, and as we understand it, it was actually the Jones High School administration and local community that recruited him. They had known about him. They had known that he was looking for a position such as this, and they felt they wanted him to come back to the Central Florida community and be this shining light because, you know, not only did someone like Dr. Foster at FAMU realize the opportunity involved in having a music program that can kind of integrate itself into a larger urban community like Orlando, but so did the parents and the teachers and the administrators at Jones High. And they, you know, recruited him, came in, and they said, you know, we want you to be kind of the shining star of the community, and we want you to, you know, to be the public face of Paramore.
Lisa, what other characters jumped out at you when you're making this film and learning this story and following along with the rest of us? Who popped out at you that really stood out?
Del Kiefner was another important character in telling this story. Originally, we were going to do the story about the Jones High School marching band traveling to the World's Fair in 1964. And through our research with the students, we realized that another Orlando band went to the World's Fair in 64 as well, and that was the Edgewater Marching Eagles, the pride of College Park. And they were led by another dynamic character, Del Kiefner. And Del and Jim Wilson were friends. Their friendship crossed the color line in Orlando in 1964. And they actually wound up working together to make sure that the white community and the black community were both fundraising and getting all of the funds needed to send both of these high school marching bands to the World's Fair for this great experience.
And Robert kind of mentioned it before where, you know, Orlando seemed to be a little more forward-thinking when it came to race relations and civil rights in that time. And it sounds like, you know, these two band directors were doing the same thing here, right?
They were. They wanted to use music to bring the community together. And that's what's such an interesting part of this story is that Orlando was doing something unusual, unique, and terrific at that time. At the same time, there were race riots going on in St. Augustine. Dr. King was jailed there. There was racial unrest in Jacksonville and Miami. Orlando, this agricultural community, as Robert said, was trying to move forward. the time. People didn't even realize it, but it was being eyed by Disney. So all of these factors came together to move this community forward.
Robert, an interesting part of the story is, as you say, the students here living in a little more progressive area, people trying to be a little more different like Atlanta. But when they go on this World's Fair trip in 1964, they drive through the South and they get quite a reality check as to what's really the relationship, the race relationships out there in the civil rights. Can you talk a little bit about their trip up to the World's Fair?
Sure. And, you know, one thing I want to preface this with is, you know, they're certainly, if you compare Orlando to places like Birmingham and Mississippi and things like this, you know, certainly as far as race relation goes, Orlando was much more progressive. But there were incidents and there was tension, and we got that in the interviews where people said it just kind of bubbled under the surface, and there certainly were protests, and these things were not reported in the Orlando Sentinel. And what we found was interesting was one of the things Chief told us was that he had to kind of prepare the students for travel throughout the South because he felt what they were going to experience when they go through the Deep South up to eventually Washington, D.C., and then on to New York were things and customs and etiquette that weren't as entrenched as in Orlando. And he felt that they were not going to be prepared to kind of walk into a place where the color line might be much more enforced and much more, you know, much more entrenched than what they've been used to here.
And how did Chief feel about that role, kind of teaching these kids not only music but also how to interact in this society that was so divided and so segregated?
Well, I think that came, you know, with the territory. I mean, you know, imagine being a teacher in the Jim Crow era. I mean, I don't think, you know, one sees themselves purely as, well, I'm going to teach history, I'm going to teach mathematics, the quadratic equation. The idea of living and trying to overturn Jim Crow segregation, I think, you know, is just part of the recipe, part of the mix, especially if you're a young African-American student or an African-American teacher at a segregated school in the 1940s, 1950s, you know, through the 60s.
Now, Lisa, when you spoke to some of these band students years later for this film, what did they make of that trip to the World's Fair? What did they take away from that trip through the segregated South?
Well, our students interviewed alumni from both Jones High School and Edgewater High School. And what we got from them was very interesting because if you think about being a teenager, they were aware in 1964 of all that was going on from watching television and reading the newspaper. As Robert mentioned, a lot of the civil rights activities in Orlando were not covered by the media here. We do have an interview with one of the band alumni in the documentary talking about a sit-in during which she was arrested. But these alumni were high school kids. You know, they were worried about passing their exams. They were excited about raising the money that they needed to raise to go on the trip. They knew that their band directors wanted them to perform well. So they were more concerned with the things that regular high school students were concerned with. And it's interesting, the white Edgewater alumni, in looking back, they do describe to us that one of them says that the only black person that she saw in Edgewater High School at that time was the custodian.
Robert, what did these students bring back to their community after this trip?
Well, that's really interesting because, you know, one of the things we wrestled with, I mean, in all the films we make, but very specifically this film, was sort of the legacy because we really are trying to figure out what's the legacy of this event. And one of the interesting things we learned was that so many of these people who were, part of the band, who were touched by Chief Wilson as a mentor, as a teacher, as an instructor, went away to college and came back. And many of them came back to Jones High and taught, became administrators, became active in the community in one way, shape, or form. So, I mean, it's almost like he seeded this entire next generation of local community leaders.
Now, Lisa, the Jones High School Marching Band is still going strong today, right? What are they up to now?
That's right. We have an opportunity at the end of the film to bring it full circle because the right now they are working on fundraising to send not only the marching band but also the chorus back to New York. We have the choir under the direction of Andrea Green and the Jones High School Wind Ensemble under the direction of Jamal W. Nicholas. And they are going to be performing at Carnegie Hall in April. And right now they're going through the same fundraising activities as the 1964 Jones High School kids. Car washes, bake sales, dinners. We're hoping that they'll raise the funds, be able to take this trip, and the story can come full circle.
Well, Robert Casanella is an assistant professor of history at the University of Central Florida. Robert, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And Lisa Mills, she's the associate professor of film in the School of Visual Art and Design at the University of Central Florida. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Coming up, the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex is gearing up for future explorers to experience what life will be like as an astronaut in the Mars generation. A conversation with astronaut John McBride about the next generation of astronauts. That's ahead when Intersection continues. This is Intersection. I'm Brendan Byrne. As the Space Coast roars back to life thanks to commercial space companies, the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex is adding a host of new exhibits for space enthusiasts. From a new astronaut training experience to holidays at the park, there's plenty for future explorers. Well, joining me in the studio is astronaut John McBride. He was the pilot of STS-41G Challenger. John, thanks for joining me.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
And Rebecca Sherman, she is PR and Communications Manager at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Rebecca, let's start with you. What's new at the Visitor Complex this year?
Well, we have so much going on this year. You know, of course, lots of launches. We offer the closest public viewing for launches and, you know, an astronaut every day. So that's always an exciting part of a visitor's experience. And last year in November, we opened Heroes and Legends. So that's a brand new attraction that we were very excited about. And very soon, in the beginning of next year, we'll be opening a brand new astronaut training experience. So anyone who's familiar with the current program, it's all about the space shuttle missions, and it's been a very popular program. And now where it's been reimagined and redesigned to focus on the journey to Mars and deep space exploration. It has technology like full motion simulators, virtual reality. It's immersive. It's amazing, like nothing else on Earth.
Now, I'm an alumni of the original
astronaut
training experience back in the late 90s, I went. What's going to be a little bit different from that? I mean, I remember doing a lot of space shuttle training and moonwalk training. What's new with the new reincarnation of
We do have a simulated microgravity experience that we're calling spacewalk training. So guests will be able to do that and really feel like they're working in zero gravity. So all of those, you know, challenges that a lot of people may not think of when they think of a spacewalk, they'll get to experience themselves in a full motion simulator. So you get to experience landing and driving on Mars, and it's tilts and sways 360 degrees. So if you want to go all the way around, not for me, but your others are welcome to do that. And virtual reality. So you really get immersed into the experience of going to Mars and living and working there.
John McBride, is this similar to what you experienced training in the astronaut corps? This is probably a little bit easier, huh?
It's, Mars and space shuttle are kind of different animals. But in either case, it's pretty extensive training that we go through to prepare ourselves physically and mentally. And you got to learn all the systems. Of course, all the systems for Mars will be different than the ones for the shuttle. But basically, once you're in weightlessness, it's all the same then until you land on Mars. And then Earth's gravity is, I guess, three times as strong as Mars' gravity. So if you weigh 180 pounds, you're on Earth, you'd weigh 60 pounds on Mars. So it'd be a little easier to walk. Except you're going to have 5 or 6 inches of dust and dirt and soil to plunder through. But training is training. It's pretty extensive, and pretty involved, and it takes some dedication to get all the way through it.
Have you been to the training complex and seen some of the kids that are going through through the program?
I still work at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex almost on a daily basis, so yes, I've seen it. I've watched it develop, had a little bit to do with the initial design reviews, and so it's going to be something. We're all very proud of it. We're looking forward to opening early next year.
What's it like for you seeing, you know, kids getting excited about this stuff and running around and playing, but also learning at the same time? It's going to be awesome.
It's one of my favorite things, because I look back on my childhood and I was inspired by people that came and talked about futuristic things and the possibilities that you can pretty much do anything you want to do. So I love to see the sparkle in kids' eyes when I talk to them about them being perhaps the first person to walk on Mars one of these days, and you can see their eyes light up. And hopefully they always say, well, what do I have to do? And the most important thing, obviously, is study. Stay in school. The better education you get, the more opportunities you'll have, not only to come down and fly to Mars, but to do anything you want to do with your life. So concentrate on your education.
Rebecca, what goes into creating these programs? I mean, do you work closely with some of the schools in the area to kind of develop a curriculum, or what's the partnership you all have?
Absolutely. We have an education department within the visitor complex itself. And so naturally, education is a huge focus in anything and everything that we do. But particularly with, you know, the new astronaut training experience, for example, we work closely with NASA and school programs to make sure that everything has the STEM focused component, so that, you know, teachers will bring students and families will bring their kids, and they'll not only be entertained, but educated and learn about all the different challenges that we'll face as we try and get to Mars. So it's definitely one of our top focuses, if not the top focus, to be authentic, to be fun, and, you know, so that families and schools learn and, you know, really appreciate the space program and hopefully are inspired, if they're a child, to one day work in that program.
John, do you see programs like this drumming up public support for space programs? You know, I'm thinking back to the end of the shuttle program. There was a bit of a lull on the Space Coast. Does something like this help kind of get that younger generation excited about Mars?
I certainly think so, and we do. I was inspired by John Kennedy and the early space program, and we sort of need that same kind of enthusiasm and synergism today to get the youngsters involved in science and space and technology and all those types of things. So we have a wonderful opportunity for them to come out there and witness space firsthand at the Kennedy Space Center and all the new things that are happening. And the focus on Mars really gives these kids an opportunity to come out there and see what they can do in the future.
Rebecca, you mentioned this earlier. Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex also offers launch viewing. Mm-hmm. And when you think back to the transition of the Kennedy Space Center into a multi-user spaceport, you see all sorts of private companies in there now, between SpaceX, ULA, soon to be Blue Origin. What's it like to see a launch at the visitor complex, and is there that desire for people to go out there and see it?
Yes, we're certainly seeing an increase in people that want to come see it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and you can't really describe it without, you know, you really have to see it and feel it to believe it, because you don't just see it. You feel the rumble, you know, you see just the amazing power that these vehicles have, and it really inspires everyone around you and yourself to want to journey further and continue exploring.
Now, John, you can get pretty close to a launch at the Kennedy Space Center, but I don't think you can get any closer than you have actually launching on a shuttle. And soon we're going to have American crew launching to the International Space Station from Florida Space Coast again. Can you describe what it's like to walk down that gantry and get on that shuttle and be blasted off into space? What is that experience
like? Well, it's
like
a culmination of lifelong dreams and years of training and preparation. And when you finally get down there, we go down, as a matter of fact, in the shuttle. I'm sure they'll do it in the Mars program. We go down about a month before the actual liftoff, and it's called a dry countdown test, where we do everything except start the engines. So we stay in the crew quarters, we get in our suits, and we take the van out to the launch pad and go up the elevator, get strapped into our seats and do the countdown, except don't start the engines. So we've gone that far. But the morning you walk out for in reality and know this is the day, we hope, We're not going to get canceled. My flight, by the way, is the first flight that's in the shuttle history that had a scheduled launch date. We launched on time and had a scheduled landing time, and we landed on time. No delays. No. So the morning we woke up knowing, and you get up about 4 hours before launch, no matter what time it is. And about 2 hours before the launch, you get on the bus and go out to the launch pad, and you feel this time there's a little bit of tingling, I guess you'd say, in your fingers, your body, as you realize this is the time. This is going to be it, we hope. And it was a great anticipation and excitement that you go through that final couple hours. You get in, everybody's kind of strapped in and ready to go about an hour before launch, or the last person. And you're there on your back, and you're thinking, this, we're getting closer and closer and closer. And when you get to, you know, 10 minutes, the actual things start counting down in reality. And 30 seconds before launch, we're still counting down, and we, you know, all the controls come on board then. We have charge of all the controls at the 30 seconds before launch. And at 10 seconds, and we start the engine and the shuttle 6 seconds before launch. And you can, when those things start, generally you're going to go. We had one time where we shut down within the six-second period, but generally if they start, you're going to go fly. And ours was flawless. Had no problems during the launch and very few problems in orbit, and came back and landed on time. So it was all in all a very successful, very exciting, obviously the culmination of many years of dreams and preparation to get to that point.
What's that moment you know you're in space? When did you feel it?
Well, you feel it after 8.5 minutes. It only takes that long to get to space, but we're, the pilots particularly up front, are strapped in for another 40 or so minutes as we do all the post-insertion procedures, shutting down all the stuff we use for launch, getting ready for on-orbit operation. So it's 40 or so minutes before the two of us up front ever get out of our seats. While everybody else is stowing equipment, we still are in a shutdown mode. But after about 40 minutes in the seat, and you finally realize, I'm in space. When you take your seatbelt loose, you don't have to get up and walk anymore. And the folks before me told me, if you just push in the right direction on your seat, when the time comes, you'll float up out of your chair. And if you push exactly the right angle, you'll do a somersault and you'll end up behind your seat, where I have to be as a pilot to open the payload bay doors. And I did all that stuff, and it worked. Wow, this is off to a good start. And 45 minutes after you're in space, you're on the other side of the Earth. We were over Australia in 45 minutes. And just to think that I've now been in space 45 minutes, but I've traveled halfway around the Earth. So it just gets better and better.
Rebecca, a lot of the things that you're working on at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex are very forward-looking now. So you're looking at future missions to Mars. Kind of walk us through some of those things that are getting visitors interested in our long-term ambitions in space exploration.
Sure. Well, we definitely have a focus on past, present, and future. So using the past to really inspire the future and the future space explorers. So we have everything from, you know, the Dragon, the very first commercial resupply to the International Space Station. We have some Starliner mock-ups from Boeing. So people really get to see up close, you know, what the future is going to look like. And we also have the past, you know, we have Space Shuttle Atlantis, which is a breathtaking exhibit that's not to be missed. And we also do our bus tours, which is, of course, very popular, gets you closer, you know, to NASA than you can really get anywhere else. Go behind the gates to that secured area and see the vehicle assembly building. You can see the space partners like SpaceX and ULA. You see the launch pad. So you really get the sense that there's a lot of work going on that a lot of people don't get to see, and it really inspires people.
John, you started the Meet an Astronaut program at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, and when I talk to folks that have been out there, that's the one thing that sticks out for them, the fact that they get to meet someone who's been to space, and they're so accessible like that. Can you kind of talk about where that idea came from and where you'd like to see it go and how it's working out?
Sure. I guess it was the year 2000. I was president of the astronaut, ASE, we call it, the Society of, you know, all the astronauts and cosmonauts of the world. And we were looking for ways to expand our presence. And I talked to the management at Kennedy Space Center about let's have an astronaut here every day. And then, well, let's not try it every day. Let's do it two or three times a week and see how it goes. So I was the first person that did it in the year 2000. It was so popular after that first week that we started doing it every day. I had to bring on two or three more astronauts because I couldn't do it all the time. We call it the Astronaut Encounter Program, and initiation was outdoors in an arena. It's gotten so popular and grown so much, we've built our own theater called the Astronaut Encounter Theater, which holds, I think, 300 or 400 people. And generally, it's filled for the presentation. So it's been going on now since 2000. And I have now, I do the scheduling. We're up to 40 different astronauts, men and women, a couple of foreign nationals from Mexico and Brazil who come and talk daily to our visiting crowds, and it's become very popular. It's gone from one or two presentations a day to, I think, depending on the time of the year, two or three encounters in the theater. Plus, you can dine with an astronaut, lunch with an astronaut. And then during the Christmas season, we're going to have dinner with an astronaut where you can come out and have lunch and or dinner with an astronaut. So it's kind of started off kind of rudimentary, but it's grown over the years to it's a pretty popular program. We now also do fly with an astronaut where you can come down, and we're limited to one busload of people per day. So it's, I think, 43 people and the astronaut can go on this private tour around the Kennedy Space Center and start off with a ride and the shuttle launch experience, and then it's a very fascinating encounter.
One of my favorite moments whenever I attend the astronaut encounter is the Q&A. What are some of the more interesting or your favorite questions you get from folks that ask you about your time in the astronaut corps?
I think my very favorite question, and probably for eternity, was a young kid, probably 6 or 7 years old. You could tell during the whole program that he was just getting more and more excited about what he was listening to. And at the opening of the questions, he wanted to be the first guy. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he stood up and he said, "When's NASA going to take a kid into space?" Because he wanted to be that person. So that's the most rewarding part of the whole thing, is to see the gleam in their eyes when you can excite them and maybe encourage them to go do some good things with their lives.
Are you concerned that there's fewer and fewer kids like that these days?
It does concern me. When I was in school, of course, that's a few years ago, there was our teachers encouraged us to study math and science and chemistry and all those types of things. I don't feel the encouragement today that I felt back in my day. And I think we're losing a little bit of our emphasis in science and technology because of that.
Rebecca, with the holidays around the corner, anything special going on at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex?
Well, of course, we have our holidays in space, and this year we have a group called Fighting Gravity, which you may have seen on America's Got Talent. They placed third in the national competition, and they have a really unique black light dance performance that they do, and they'll be at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex nightly for shows starting December 20th. So we're very excited to have it. It's a little different than what we've done in years past, but it will be entertaining and inspiring, just like any visit to Kennedy should be.
John, I'll give you the final word. When new people come out to the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, they're checking out all these new things, they're encountering astronauts. What do you want them to take away?
I want them to take away their pride in America's space program. The things that we've done in the past, the things we're doing now, and, of course, the things we're going to do in the future. We need to start encouraging kids like I was encouraged to do those types of things. So I try to do it each and every opportunity I have. And hopefully one of these days, I challenge all the kids when they get their mission to Mars, that the first person to call me and let me know, because I certainly want to come to their launch.
John McBride, he was a pilot on STS-41G, which was Challenger. John, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
And Rebecca Sherman, she is PR and Communications Manager at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's executive producer is Catherine Welch. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen on the NPR One app or visit our website, WMFE.org, to listen back to previous episodes. I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.